Hi, Slave Is Gone listeners. Breezy here with Jericho to tell you about another podcast we think you'd like called The Slowdown. Each weekday, The Slowdown delivers short episodes that guide you to understand our common journey through poetry.
The Slowdown has had some great hosts, including Tracy K. Smith and our guest on this episode of The Slave Is Gone, Ada Limone. And the new host is the award-winning poet and writer, Major Jackson.
Join Major Jackson for a hand-picked poem and a moment of reflection every weekday.
Produced by APM Studios in partnership with the Poetry Foundation, you can listen to The Slowdown now, wherever you get podcasts.
I robbed the woods, the trusting woods, the unsuspecting trees, brought out their burrs and mosses, my fantasy to please. I scanned their trinkets curious, I grasped, I bore away. What will the solemn hemlock, what will the oak tree say?
This is The Slave Is Gone, the show that talks back to Apple TV's Dickinson.
I'm Jericho Brown.
And I'm Brianne Janae, but you can call me Breezy.
We explore what's historically true, what's emotionally true, what works for us.
And what doesn't, in the Apple TV series about Dickinson's coming of age.
And because we're poets who are fascinated by Dickinson's verse, we always bring it back to the poetry. Hey, Breezy.
Hey, Jericho.
We are back talking about Dickinson, talking about Emily Dickinson, talking about poetry and nature, marriage, and literary heroes. We'll have the insights of our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray.
Yes, and it's so good to have our special guest, the new U.S. Poet Laureate, Ada Limone, to unpack and break it down with us. So let's get into it. Dickinson, Season 1, Episode 4, Alone I Cannot Be. Emily and her brother Austin are distraught. Sue, Emily's lover and Austin's fiance, aka the heart of this ongoing situationship, has fled to Boston to work as a governess.
But Emily takes solace by reading Walden, the book by Henry David Thoreau in which he writes about the joys of living alone in nature. She reads it under the oak tree her great-grandfather planted.
When Emily learns that the town plans to chop down the tree to make way for a railroad, she throws a tantrum. While her father, who supports the tree chopping, asks her brother Austin to write a poem to commemorate the start of the railroad's construction, just to spite her.
Austin struggles to write a line, and their sister Lavinia seems to think that if she is abducted by Indians, perhaps the chief will have a handsome son she can marry.
Meanwhile, with the help of her suitor George, Emily seeks out Thoreau to see if he'll help her cause. On the train ride to Walden Pond, George imagines their future together with Emily as his wife. Emily responds by saying if she were a man, she'd want a wife too.
When they finally arrive, they discover the real Walden isn't nearly as isolated as the literary one, and that Thoreau is far from self-sufficient in his wooded retreat.
Dejected, Emily returns home where her father tells her the railroad will be rerouted and the old tree will be saved.
I think this episode is really an episode about misrepresentation. You know, Thoreau has been misrepresenting himself, at least through this episode. We'll find out just how much he was misrepresenting himself in real life. Obviously, Lavinia has some huge misrepresentation issues going around with this headdress on. And then there's this idea that because somebody is your firstborn son, that they can just whip up a poem, which I think was also a little bit of a great big of misrepresentation about what poetry is and what poetry does. And I think it is a misrepresentation that I live. I think the hard, I mean, I always tell people this, the hardest thing in the world about being a poet is translation. Nobody knows what the hell you're doing. And when you tell them, they don't believe you. I mean, one of the things that we're gonna get into in this episode is my dating life.
Of course.
yours, of course.
This episode is about my dating life and how, you know, when I meet a nice guy and he says, what do you do? And I tell him I'm a poet, he says, yeah, oh, but right, really, poems. What do you do? Like yeah. He's either telling me that or he asks me to write him one right now. Say a poem.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt for Austin when he was sort of laying there just being like, poetry, poetry. How do I do this? You know, because it felt relatable even as somebody who does write poetry. To be asked to write a poem on the spot, like it just comes up on command.
Well, it was definitely relatable to me because I have not been writing as much as I would like to lately.
Me neither.
Or at least not coming away with anything that feels like, you know, sometimes you write and it's proof to you of your own identity. Even when you're not doing so well, you're doing well enough where you can be like, oh, look, I guess I'm a poet. Look at that line, you know? And then you sort of feel, I don't know, you feel shored up. You feel like, okay, this mess I made of my life was for a reason. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, and it's amazing how easy it is to lose that identity or feel that you're losing that identity the moment you go through a lull and the poems aren't coming.
It's definitely an identity you fight for.
Do you feel that like solitude and sort of like isolation or nature influences your identity as a poet? Just like, I mean, I'm thinking about Emily in this episode sort of being like, I need my isolation. I need this tree. I need to be alone to be able to write.
Yes, yes. And I respect that. In particular, I really like the way that the show found, it seemed like that moment where the show quotes that Dickinson poem, there's something like in the name of,
and then the name the last of the bees. Line,
and yeah, the something, the something and the bee. The
yeah.
The breeze and the, I mean, it's so beautiful. And the timing of that is really perfect. And I do think, I mean, obviously I wouldn't have been able to write my last book if I didn't have a personal and I think spiritual relationship to the natural world. But I also think that I'm not a writer. I'm not Robert Bly. You know, I'm not even a writer who needs to go. I love Robert Bly, by the way. I miss Robert Bly every day. I mean, we need more Robert Blys. And I want another Robert Bly type who is not Robert Bly to show up and give a reading for 3 hours straight. Robert Bly would give a read, Breezy. Did you ever see Robert Bly read?
No,
Robert Bly
I didn't.
Would be in the middle of reading his own poem and stop and say, that was good to me. Let me read that line again.
Yeah.
He's like, go here, Robert. So anyway, what was I talking about, Robert Bly? Oh, I like the idea of having a tree that I can see out of a window. Mm-hmm. I do not like the idea of going away. It scares me to pieces.
Yeah.
You know yeah. What I mean?
That's so weird. That's so real. I love I like going away. I like the idea of going into the wilderness to write. Mm-hmm. But I do start to feel like a white girl in a horror film.
Yeah.
I would be so embarrassed if somebody got me out in those woods because my ancestors told me don't be out there, but I'd be going anyway. Because it feels nice, you know, like to be with the trees and to with the silence. But then also I'd be like, oh my God, don't let me die out here. Like, so ashamed.
Breezy, if you're a white girl in a horror film, you might survive. You know, black girls in horror films don't make
right?
it after the first scene.
You were so true. You were somehow, some way, the killer might just let me go.
This is a good time for us to introduce Ada. I'm really excited to have Ada Limone here with us. I think of her as poetry royalty. Ada Limone's latest book of poetry, The Hurting Kind, is just out from Milkweed Editions. And now she is the newly named U.S. Poet Laureate. Congratulations, Ada, and thank you so much for joining us on The Slave Is Gone.
Ada is the author of 6 books of poetry, including The Carrying, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. She is also the host of the critically acclaimed poetry podcast, The Slowdown.
Such a wonderful pleasure to be here. You know, I adore you both, so it's just, you know, an honor to be in your presence and also to talk about this show. And I could talk about trees all day long, so...
Yeah. Do you have one that's special to you, or do you? Have well, some, there you go.
It's interesting because I love what you said about like, I like to like have a tree to look out the window, but this idea of like not going somewhere or having it a specific, like, oh, I need to go out into the woods. Mm-hmm. Which is actually right. It already sets that up for the Thoreau Dickinson idea, right? Mm-hmm. One is like, I must go get sort of lost. And the mm-hmm. other one is like, no, there's one right here.
Yeah, in my backyard. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was just telling someone the other day that I look out, my window looks out onto this incredible, you know, 100 foot tall silver maple. And it's my favorite tree. I adore it. And every time I'm kind of stuck or like, you know, trying to figure out my way into something, I just kind of look and usually there's something that comes from watching that tree. And it's a real gift. But I agree. You know, as much as I actually do like to go into the woods sometimes, I feel like we always sort of forget that, you know, our idea of connectedness to nature, it's all around us, you know, it's everywhere. You live in Brooklyn. Yeah. There's a million trees on the streets. Yeah. You know, it's not like you have to go somewhere to find nature.
That's so true. I just moved, but in my last apartment, there was this tree that like was right outside of my window. And I would just watch the different birds that came. There were these blue jays. There I saw woodpeckers occasionally. And it would just be sort of like, okay, what are the birds doing today? Who's out there hanging out in the tree? I would turn on Aretha Franklin's Tree of Life and just sort of like have a whole moment.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. What a wonderful way to start the day.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I mean, I guess that's why it was so upsetting to me that her father made her go do all this complaining and being upset when he could have just heard her out right from the beginning over that tree that her grandfather, her great-grandfather had planted. And I love that they gave us that detail, you know, like this, this tree as like a connection to ancestry and heritage.
Yeah, but Emily Dickinson's father, in this show at least, his inability to take her seriously, which I understand is supposedly about its time, seems really odd considering the amount of power we're also supposed to believe that he has. All of this is resolved because he could just do it.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I could just tell somebody not to put a railroad through something I don't want a railroad to go through. Do you know what I mean? Or a pipeline for that matter. I think maybe the show, you know, I'm always critiquing the show for where it's aware of itself and where it's not. Mm-hmm. But I thought this show was very good at being aware of itself. And then at the end, I don't think they understood what they were showing me. You know, we are in the 21st century still dealing with city, states, and federal governments putting infrastructure where it should not be. Infrastructure that dishonors people's ancestors. Yeah. That dishonors living people. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm still walking down, you know, passing by this or that Confederate monument or walking around this or that Robert E. Lee Boulevard all over the nation. And yet you want to lay down stuff where people are begging you not to lay it down, roads, pipelines, and everything else.
Yeah.
And then the truth is, this is what bothers me. The truth is, it's as simple as you can put it some fucking where else. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, anyway, but they do when the right people complain.
That's what is particularly ironic and maybe a little bit ridiculous about this show that wanted to also show us Native peoples, you know, Indigenous people.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that this show that wants so desperately to be diverse, and I admire and laud that desire, don't see that connection. I don't think they see that connection coming up again at the end of the show, where Emily Dickinson can make a decision about her land and her father can make a decision about his land. You know what I mean? Yeah. And other people don't get the opportunities to make that decision about their own land.
When what was happening to Native people was them having their land taken, it's really tone deaf. Mm.
I wanted to ask you what you thought the first time you were watching the scene, the show, and you saw the scene with Lavinia walking around town with this headdress on. What was the first thought that entered your mind?
I think like most people, I have this sort of aversion immediately to any of that sort of headdress garb or whatever it is. And it reminds me, immediately takes me back to being a young person when we would actually do that in schools, right? Mm-hmm. For Thanksgiving. But I also think it was fascinating in how it did bring up, like in terms of what this particular episode was about, how it brought, what sort of dovetailed with Thoreau's speaking back when he said, you know, I care about my woods. Why would I care about your tree? Mm. And it sort of was this idea of ownership.
But when Emily and Lavinia's mother says to Lavinia, why do you think the Indians would want you?
Yeah. I love that.
I mean, you know, I was bothered, but then I was like, okay, y'all are paying attention. Mm-hmm. But y'all actually know that for these particular people, white people are not the goal.
Right.
And white ways of being is not necessarily what we are looking forward to. We Indigenous people are not interested in possessing you for some, which I really liked about the show.
Yeah.
Aoife, are you here with us? Can you come? I wanted to ask you about the five Native people observing the railroad ribbon cutting scene. Yeah. That shows, why are they, in your estimation, why are they included in the scene? And what are audiences supposed to take from Lavinia's wearing of this headdress? Who were the Native people in 19th century Amherst? Why are there so few representations of them in the show? And we do get them, we get them so that people can understand. It's almost like they're there so we can understand, oh yeah, we know they were there.
I want to say that I love this episode because I think there's this Indigenous theme running through it. And I was really glad to see those five disgruntled men standing a little bit apart, because it felt like it mimicked the economic, spatial marginalization that people had been chased out of the Connecticut River Valley, where Amherst is, chased up into the hills, land, right? Treaties, deceptive treaties dishonored. So I loved the placement, right? That they're at the back of the scene. And it hints at the fact that that railroad is not going through Edwards land, or it's Edwards land now, but for thousands of years, it belonged to the Nunatuck, whose land Amherst is in. I actually love episode 4 because of that, and because of Lavinia dressed in the headdress. I know, Ada, I totally get it, the cringing thing about dressing like that. And the reference is the 19th century is just mad for this idea of the disappearing Indian, mad for the story of Mary Rowlandson, who's the most famous white colonial captive, who stays with the Pocumtuck during St. King Philip or Metacom's War. And it happens 200 years before, but the 19th century is just has this incredible thirst for these captivity stories. Mm. And I think actually, and I'm going to give like points to the show writers, I think that they were trying to make us in the 21st century think about a white woman is missing. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's going on in the 19th century at that time, right, is this development of in literature of the disappearing Indian. Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha, you have Hope Leslie by Sedgwick, and then you have Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans. So those things are, people are just eating them up at the same time that there are Indigenous people, Cherokee, Mohegan writers, Samson Oakum, writing at that time, Elias Boudinot, William Appice, who's actually was born north of along the Connecticut River from Amherst, who are taking colonial language and feeding it back. They're taking the language of the colonialists around, and a lot of them are ministers. So they're taking that sort of Christianity, language of Christianity in the word, and feeding it back to make white people see what they're doing and what they've done. To me, it feels like an incredibly rich episode to think about what's going on. And in the same time that there's this starting to be a really robust Indigenous literature, Emily Dickinson's playmate from when she was a little girl, Helen Hunt Jackson, is publishing Ramona, which mm-hmm. is about California genocide. It's like the Uncle Tom's Cabin for decimation of the tribes of California. So this is all happening in the background. So I actually love that, including through the Thoreau stuff.
Thanks to Smith College for its sponsorship of The Slave Is Gone.
Smith first opened its doors to students in 1871, when Emily Dickinson was still living and writing up the road in Amherst.
And just like no one at that time would have imagined that Emily Dickinson's poems would be read around the world, they'd probably also be surprised by the impact this women's college continues to have more than 150 years later.
Smith's faculty, students, and community of alums are driving change in the world, making knowledge a force for good.
Whether you're a parent, a prospective student, an academic professional, or someone who counts yourself as part of the Smith community, learn about Smith now at smith.edu. Soon after that is the train ride. And Ada, you could tell me if I'm wrong. Breezy, you can tell I said it already earlier.
Your love of George.
I just feel like, if George, I could get it. I think I would understand it better. I'll say this. Like, if I met George literally, mm-hmm. I probably would not give him the time of day. Mm-hmm. But I would not give him the time of day. I wouldn't be taking train rides with him. She is breaking this man's heart.
He's the one that literally said to her, you can't travel alone. You know, he knows she's using him. You know,
yeah,
he knows his son, you know, she needs a man for this trip, and he's willing to be that man.
It's so sad.
But also I feel like very true. It feels very authentic to me, the way she's interacting with him, which is she knows she needs someone to do some of these things, mm-hmm. and she is using him. Mm-hmm. But unlike sort of what we talk about now in terms of using, I think that this is also like, it's access to the world. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's access mm-hmm. to yeah. transportation. It's access to, right? It's That's not smart. Just yeah. this moment of like, oh, I'm using this person.
It's not romance.
She doesn't even want his company. I mean, she says, mm-hmm. I want to be alone.
And she makes it clear that she's obsessed with Sue.
Yeah.
Something about like burning with desire for her or something. Yeah. And George mm-hmm. was like, oh, I'd be happy if you wrote that about me. Yeah. He knows, yeah. like he's acknowledging that like, oh, you have these intense feelings for this woman, but what about me? You know, mm-hmm. like he knows he's begging.
And I'll say this. I think that there's also like, so I agree that, you know, there's a certain use that, you know, she's doing with him, like she's using him. But I also think there's a part where it annoys me when people don't listen. And I also feel like sometimes you can be very, very kind, but still be saying like, I want to be alone and I want to, but I am also being kind because I want you as a friend and I want you, you know,
yeah.
and I feel like he's not listening. And that always, I think even just as a, you know, human woman in the world, that there are moments where I'm like, wow, you're really choosing not to listen to what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. George is not doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
The trouble is he's doing within a system that is wrong. Mm. And he can't, you know, it's like the same thing, like when people would complain about Barack Obama, I'm like, he's the president, but he's still the president of, I don't know, the United States of America. like he's not, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get that right. I know how that got here. So you're not going to get that right. Do you know what I mean? And the same thing is happening with Emily and George, where she has the foresight. She knows like you're doing all these things and what you're doing is really great, but I can't be who I need to be and be married to you. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. I mean, that and the fact that I like girls.
Yeah.
Right. Like in terms of just like what I like Sue.
You see it on the train when she's busy trying to write a letter to Sue.
Yeah.
And he's just like, talk to me. It's wild that he can't see that's what the relationship would be, you know,
her trying to write his
passion. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. I was just going to say, I feel like I'm jumping on what you were saying, Breezy, but that's because I'm in agreement, which is that because Jericho had just said that he's doing nothing wrong. And I was saying, well, I will go back to say that the one thing he is doing wrong is I don't think he's listening.
Yeah.
No, he's not. He's not listening.
Not at all.
He's not listening. And he's exercising a large amount of ego. He has this idea that Emily does not know what's best for herself. And that plays into the bigger and larger problem, right? Yeah. He understands, like, I'm a great guy. And after that, all he can see is she's going to need a great guy, opposed to having imagination enough to see that she might be able to handle some of her needs herself, right? Yeah, I see that. It's just, you know, I mean, Emily don't want a George, so I don't know why nobody will send me a George. That's really the
You just want snacks on a train.
You know, he brought opium last episode, right?
Yeah.
He brought weed this episode. What else do we, I mean,
George,
this guy is interested in keeping you high. Emily is influenced by Walden Pond. She asks George if he read it. He said, couldn't get through it. What is the popularity of that book at that time? I sometimes, for instance, a book like Moby Dick seems to be a book that is popular 100 years later. Do you understand what I mean? But at the moment, nobody's really reading about the whale. Is that the case? Mm-hmm. For what's the case with Thoreau as a writer?
Well, let's measure Thoreau's popularity in terms of how Dickinson, who's a really good reader, thinks about it. She was mad for it. She was mad for it. Did you have a time when you were a teenager where you and your friends would like be mad for a singer and then like speak in the lyrics of their songs? So when George actually quotes Thoreau on the train, it made me think about the fact that when someone would quote Thoreau to Dickinson, it was this like immediate intimacy maker because she was so mad for him.
If we talk about this conversation that they're having on the train, though, maybe we can introduce that conversation with a poem from A. Lamone. She told us she had a wife poem. And I think maybe now is a good time for us to hear it before we get to another poem that's a tree poem.
Yeah, I thought about it as I was rewatching the episode, and I was thinking about how, you know, she's struggling already with the concept of wife and like, oh yeah, then there's someone that does your laundry and there's someone. And of course we get there once we get to the cabin, we see that it's not just the wife, but it's, you know, the women in Thoreau's life that are doing that kind of caretaking. But I love that she's kind of turning it back on George and asking like, yeah, I would want that too. You know, who wouldn't want that? This is a poem that I thought of that sort of responded to that moment, if I can be so bold.
Yes, please.
This is a poem called Wife. I'm not yet comfortable with the word. It's short, clean whoosh that sounds like life. At dinner last night, my single girls said in admonition, it's not wife approved about a friend's upcoming trip. Their eyes rolled out and over out of their pretty young heads. Wife, why does it sound like a job? I want a wife, the famous feminist wrote, a wife who will keep my clothes clean, ironed, mended, replaced when need be. A word that could be made easily into made. A wife that does, fixes, soothes, honors, obeys, housewife, fishwife, bad wife, good wife. What's the word for someone who stares long into the morning, unable to even fix tea some days, the kettle steaming over loud like a train whistle? She who cries in the mornings, she who tears a hole in the earth and cannot stop grieving, the one who wants to love you, but often isn't good at even that, the one who doesn't want to be diminished by how much she wants to be yours.
Ada, can you talk a little bit more about the relationship you see between that poem and the scene on the train?
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, if you're willing, you could talk to us about being a wife, because you are one, and what it's like to be a poet wife in the world.
Yeah, well, I loved her argument and how resistant she was to it immediately and was outspoken about it. And that just, it felt so true to me. And I think, you know, all these years later, I had the same struggle as an artist, feeling like, oh, wife, why does that feel like a job? Why does that feel like suddenly I have to do things for someone? And I do think that as we analyze the institution of marriage, there's so much there in power structures and power dynamics, in capitalism, all of these things that always feel like, regardless of what we think of in terms of love and in terms of connection and in terms of, you know, whether or not it's, you know, a monogamous relationship, whatever it is that you want between you and your lover, that word wife comes with a lot of freaking baggage. Mm-hmm. I don't know if everyone has that thought, but I know that as an artist, it immediately was like, oh, because right, we're people that believe in language. We're people that, mm-hmm. you know, we also see the yeah. failure of language. And I think mm-hmm. that for me, it was just taking that word and being like, God, I am really having an issue with this label. And so I love that moment and how just clear-headed she is about her own opinions about what it means to be someone's wife, that, and especially did then. And that I had to do my own work to come to terms with it mm-hmm. when I got married. And of course, it's very funny because, you know, we don't have those traditional roles. We live, you know, I'm an artist. I do my own thing. We travel. We're often apart from each other, where he's, you know, he's my best friend. And Jericho, you've met Lucas, and
he is so fine, honey. I don't want to talk about him. I do not want to talk about him. He is so fine. And there you are throwing him up in our faces, girl.
But I feel like I had all these fears, and the way that I work through things, which I think I'm sure Breezy and Jericho, you feel the same as an artist, is like you work it out on the page. And then I was like, okay, I said that. I said what I needed to say. Now let's do this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's beautiful. Thanks for reading that poem.
Yeah. Well, you see how it was like, there was even a train in it. Like, I was like, this is really odd that this.
Yeah, we're meant for you. We're meant for you. Aoife, can you tell us about this particular train and about that particular tree? Are these real? Are these artifacts of history, or are they being made up for this show?
I think the show writers had fun. We don't know. Yeah. I don't think there was a tree. There definitely was a lot of land at Amherst that her father owned and developed. But as far as routing a tree, a train around a tree, I think that's the show writer's imagination. And it's an interesting one because it does point, it feels like it does two things. One is it shows Emily Dickinson as a deep naturalist. Mm-hmm. And she did love to go forest walking. She would go with her friends to look for specimens. And Breezy, she took her dog, Carla. So they went tromping together. So I think, so it does allow them to develop that piece of her story. Yeah. It does continue that really conflicting and confusing storyline with her father. So it's kind of two things going on there.
Yeah. I still remember the moment I found out she had a dog, and I was like, God, everyone talked about her being so lonely. And I was like, but she had this dog everywhere. I was like, look at that big dog that she goes on all these walks with. Her room is big and airy and bright.
What more could she want?
Breezy, you had some things to say about this meeting with Thoreau in particular, and how we find out that Thoreau is not who Thoreau has made himself to be, in particular as it relates to the women in his life.
I just appreciated how they made it clear the ways that the women in his life are sort of subsidizing his career by doing his laundry, bringing him his cookies, while he just gets to pretend to be Mr. Wilderness out in the in the woods. And I was wondering, to what degree was that portrayal accurate? You know, was Thoreau this big sham, or is that something the show got wrong? Aoife, can you tell us about Thoreau and how he's represented on the show?
It's true that Mom was nearby. It is true that Mom did the laundry. But what the show, I mean, John Mulaney likes to play contrarians, I think. So I think he really had fun with this role. What we don't know from our 21st century lens is people didn't live alone. People didn't sleep under their own roof. Mm. So it was weird. I mean, you lived in dense family configurations. Mm. So the idea of living in a cabin where you're the only person under the roof, there's nobody to turn and talk to, that was really weird. So he definitely was doing something that's really unheard of. The other thing is that people thought of the woods as chaotic, and they thought of the people of the woods, or all the people who had been socially and economically marginalized. So we're talking about both the indigenous people who are the, quote, sons of the forest or daughters of the forest, but also the Black, free Blacks who are marginalized with them, you know, specific to New England. And what was so remarkable about Thoreau is actually seeing the forest for what it was. And that idea of going to the forest to save yourself, the redemptiveness. I mean, the, you know, Breezy, when you talk about looking out the window or, right, or getting inspiration by the way the light plays through a tree coming across, you know, where you're writing or something like that. So the idea of the forest as a place that's going to save us is completely modern. It is completely like what we think now. But when he was writing about it, it was completely foreign. So he was really like ahead. And so anyway, they played up the comic stuff. I mean, it's fun. Yeah. It's really fun. But on the other hand, there's a lot of depth to Thoreau. Spent time with the Sioux. Thoreau spent huge amounts of time with the Allagash way up in Maine. So, hey, he was taking people on the Underground Railroad. I mean, he wasn't just somebody who played lip service. He was involved. He was probably one of the Secret Six who funded John Brown at Harper's Ferry. So there is a like a more rich, real person.
Right. Well, and you can get that from the books too. I mean, from the writing itself.
Yeah, I think the show really wanted us to see this because I think Thoreau himself in the show says something like, never meet your heroes or something like that. Did he say that himself? Yeah. Like, as if the character knows whenever you meet your heroes, you will be disappointed, right? They'll never meet that standard that you have of them. I mean, I was entertained by the depiction of Thoreau if he would have been anyone other than Thoreau. Do you know what I mean? Because I do know what you're saying. You feel like Thoreau is actually in it in a way that that character on the TV show is not, right? And it's too bad that Thoreau had to be the one to get used for this point about meeting your heroes. When he says, you know, I care about my trees. I don't care about your trees. He says that to Emily. Can you talk about that? I think you have a poem about a tree. Maybe you could read that for us.
I thought that that was an interesting line to have him say, because I actually don't think he would say that. I think that he would care about trees, all trees. I also just wanted to say one more thing about that scene, which was, I was really sort of moved by, if I think of it a little differently in terms of the joking about him saying like, I'm my life in extreme solitude. One of the things that did make me think of was how even as poets, when we think we're in extreme solitude or we're like, we need our time alone, how we actually do require others to do some caretaking and how many people step up and do some things for us and help us, whether it's, you know, getting a tiny grant or whether it's, you know, someone being like, hey, I know you've been working all week. Can I get you dinner or whatever it is? And I sometimes think that also, you know, that is the caretaking sometimes that the family does to let him do his work, which is, you know, something that goes unsung too, which is when we do have some folks going, how can I support you in whatever ways? And if, you know, anyone wants to drop me off cookies, sure.
I feel like too, the show is sort of asking us to think about different types of isolation.
Yeah.
Because Emily says sort of in response to him claiming to be sort of alone on Walden Pond, that like, you don't know what it is to be lonely until you have to write poems and not being able to share with someone.
Yeah.
And I think like part of sometimes a lot of that care that people are doing for you is like your friends who are willing to listen to your poem.
Yeah.
You know, when you're just like called up, like I wrote something new.
Early draft. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Completely. The one thing I remember this quote, and I have to pull it up, but it was that quote from Thoreau that is, I took a walk in the woods and came out taller than the trees, which I've always loved, this idea of like, you know, he's, but then I had this moment where I was thinking about like, but actually when I take a walk in the trees, what I love is that I disappear and I come out really much smaller than I was. And that is actually what I love. And so, and then there's also this moment in this episode where I'm going to get it wrong, but I think she says, she sits down there at the foot of her favorite tree. And she says, you know what I love about trees? And I was just thinking that I feel like that's what my whole art is about, is just me saying, hey, you know what I love about trees? So I thought I would read this poem that is about a tree. And I think it, the reason I thought of it was because it felt to me like, especially with the railroad, this has a also a something man-made that it's up against. Mm. Swear on it. Loosen the thin threads spooling in the rafters, invisible nests in night's green offerings. Divide, and then divide again. American linden looming over the streetlights. So much taller is the tree. So much taller is the tree.
Mm, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Really, that's gorgeous. Aoife, you usually have a question for the poets at the, near the end of these episodes. Do you have any questions for us?
I want to talk about the wild. What is the wild in poetry?
At its best, maybe some of the energy that drives the poem. You know, if you think of like the wildness inside of the poet, or that energy, and especially when I'm like really on and like I want to write, or I need to write, it feels like a wild type of energy.
You know, when you say the wild, I think of the phrase going out into the wild, and how that's about getting yourself ready, getting prepared, and then going to have an experience where you hope something happens that you didn't know was going to happen just because it's the wild. Do you know what I mean? So you want to see something you otherwise would not see, or hear something you otherwise would not hear, or feel a way you would otherwise not feel. And you're willing to sweat for it. You know, if you go out into the wild, you're going to sweat. You're going to get bit by mosquitoes. You're going to be tired of walking or sleeping on the ground. None of that is a good time. Sleeping on the ground is not a good time. So there's a way that that is the feeling you have when you're in a poem. When you're in a poem and you're writing and you start saying things and you have no idea what you're saying, but you understand you got to write it down to get to the point where you do know what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I do think going into the wild is probably like that.
For me, similarly, I think the wild is that sort of the part of me that feels the most free and the most unexpected. And it isn't, no one is requiring anything of that freedom and that person, that thing underneath the thing, the animal underneath the animal, the voice underneath the voice. And I feel like it's that kind of freedom that can be a little dangerous and a little scary. And you don't know what's going to happen with that wild. And I think that's my favorite part of poetry, is that it feels like, oh, I am not in control of this. Because when I think of wild, I think of untamed. And, you know, once we edit and we try to, there's a certain amount of taming that happens, but when it's actually happening and we're making, it is a free thing.
I love that, describing it as dangerous and free. That's, yeah, I feel like that speaks to so much what writing a poem is. And it speaks to so much why Emily's father is always trying to silence her and keep her from speaking up. Because heaven forbid a woman be wild and free.
Yeah.
Dangerous.
Or have wild nights.
Ada, thank you so much for being here. You have made for us a really great episode.
Oh, it was such a pleasure.
Seriously, just really wonderful.
Oh,
thank you so much
for
this. Yeah.
Thank you.
It was a really great episode. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Slave Is Gone, where we continue the conversation started by Dickinson and go way beyond.
Thanks to our special guest on this episode, Ada Limon.
That's Jericho Brown. His book, The Tradition, won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His other books include Please and The New Testament.
That's Brian Janae. Their first book is After Jubilee, and they're the author of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, which won the Cave Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize. Thanks as always to our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray, author of Made as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language.
Aoife and Lisa Rothman are the show's executive producers. Matt Martin produces the show. Mary Ann Zahorsky is the audio engineer and editor. Marissa Budlong is our research assistant. Our interns are Lola Anaya and Maggie Olszewski.
Our advisors are Dr. Marilyn Nelson and Dr. Terry Bonhorst Blackhawk. And the show receives support from Mass Humanities and the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Thanks to the many individuals who contributed to make this episode possible. You can give your support with a donation at theslaveisgone.com.
And a final thanks to Catherine Whitcomb and everyone at the Jones Library in Amherst, as well as to the Boutelle Day Poetry Center at Smith College.
We are on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us to get updates about upcoming guests and for bonus materials that take you deeper into Emily Dickinson's life and art and the world she lived in.
We'll give her the last word. Alone I cannot be, for hosts do visit me, recordless company who baffle key. They have no robes nor names, no almanacs nor climes, but general homes like gnomes. Their coming may be known by couriers within. Their going is not, for they've never gone.